Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet a man who is willing to share his experiences, his life, his story with us. Today is no different. I'm very pleased to welcome Michael Dermer, who is considered the founder of a company and an industry, the health rewards industry. Michael Dermer, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michael, considered the founder of an industry sounds very big, very complicated, very important, and quite frankly, really exhausting. What are folks talking about?
So I was a corporate lawyer in New York City and stumbled upon a business, and that business was rewarding people for being healthy. I had stumbled upon a statistic that said, you know, for every 10 pregnant women that don't follow their prenatal care, it costs the healthcare system $1 million. And I said, wait a minute. So if we gave these 10 women $10,000 each to do what they're supposed to do, the system would save $900,000. And like a lot of entrepreneurial ideas, that was the beginning of the end. I left my law practice. Business planned, and then was, the next day started what got to be known as the first company to reward people from being healthy in the early 2000s. So it was an amazing, that was, you know, kind of the idea, and from that, you know, everything followed.
Well, let's step back a bit, because that really sounds pretty amazing. I'd like to get a sense of what your early influences were like as a little boy, as a child growing up. Tell us where you lived and what kinds of things you enjoyed doing as a child.
So I grew up in Freehold, New Jersey, down in central New Jersey, not that far from the beach. And my brother and I have a brother a year apart. We grew up with a ball, right? Football, basketball, baseball, soccer, you name it. We played it. I ended up playing baseball, basketball in college. And so that experience of, you know, competing from a very, very young age. But my father always taught me, you know, two different things that I'll never forget. One was he always said, when everybody's going left, go right. And that, you know, certainly in my entrepreneurial life was front and center. And the other thing was I was the captain of teams from a very young age. In high school, I was the captain of all three sports teams. I was captain in college. And so you're almost like being a little CEO. And when that is ingrained in you from a very, very young age, you start to look at the bigger picture things. And that was just kind of part of my DNA.
It's interesting to hear you describe being the captain of various teams in school as being a little CEO. It actually makes perfect sense. I guess I just never really thought about it that way.
You know, I almost wish somebody had said that to me back then, right? Because like when you're on a basketball team, you're thinking about who all the players are. When you're a quarterback in football, you're thinking about all the things happen. But you don't think of yourself as a CEO, right? You just think of as one of the guys and hopefully providing some leadership. But I think you're developing those skills to deal with the stuff you normally deal with as a CEO, which is, you know, there's so much going on and how do you manage it all? And you have personalities. I mean, you never think of a 10-year-old quarterback having emotional intelligence, but that's kind of what you're doing when you're in the huddle. You just don't realize it at the time.
That really is a wonderful perspective. And of course, you talk a lot in The Lonely Entrepreneur about perspective. As you were growing up, at some point, as you said, you went to law school. Was that a dream for your parents, for you? How did law school come up for you?
I had an old baseball coach who worked for Merck, and he was a strategy guy, you know, as well as my father, who said, listen, you know, you're going to try to run something big someday. He goes, if you don't know exactly what you want that to be yet, go to law school, go play corporate lawyer for a couple of years and learn how, you know, money moves and deals get done and things like that. So I never really was planning to be a lawyer longer term. It was just, you know, foundational kind of experience for what they thought I wanted to do.
Again, you know, that's a really interesting perspective. Go to law school to make sure that you know what you're doing when you decide what that is. It's a wonderful foundation.
It really is. I think that, you know, sometimes, and we'll talk about it later, sometimes when entrepreneurs go right into the entrepreneurial world and they don't have the context of being exposed to other things, it's really difficult to understand how things operate in the world. So I knew, for example, I was a mergers and acquisitions lawyer, so I knew money raising, I knew how a company went public, I knew how to deal with, angel investors and private equity and venture, and so that experience was invaluable in building my company. But, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted to build something, and that also came from, the things I did in sports. It was amazing to watch a bunch of, ragtag kids get together at the beginning of a season, and at the end, if you have fortune enough to win a championship, you watch all that come together, and that to me had a lot of parallels to, building a company.
Interesting. Now, as you said, you were a corporate lawyer. So for many people, that immediately brings up pictures of cushy job, lots of money, wonderful cars, big house. I mean, all the things, there's so many things that people tend to associate with their concept of corporate lawyers. Is that what that experience was like for you?
Well, I think certainly in New York City at the big New York law firms like the one that I worked at, it's a little different perspective. I think most people are used to, working till midnight, making good money, don't get me wrong, but working really, really hard on deals that end up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. For me, because I knew I wanted to start something, the experience was different. When big company A was buying big company B, there's only 10 people on earth that know that that's happening. And when you're a 25 or 26 or 27 year old and you're talking to the CFO of a public company, I was much more interested in the business side than the legal side. So I would go to the meeting on the business side where I didn't necessarily have to be there. So I was always trying to take in that knowledge of what it was like to run a big company and the considerations that they were going through when they were doing things like the work we were doing for them, like going public or raising money or things like that. So I had a different perspective, if you will, about being a lawyer because I was really interested in the business side.
You're giving a lot of folks who are listening a tremendous plug for going to law school if they can't figure out what it is they want to do. What was it like for your family, your friends? You went to law school, a wonderful law school. You had a wonderful job. And then all of a sudden, you were giving that up and doing something different. What did family and friends think about that?
They always think, I think the technical term is you're a little nuts, right?
That sounds pretty technical.
It sounds pretty technical, right? I think for certainly the people that knew me, they always knew that I wanted to do bigger things. And so I don't think it was really surprising to anybody that when the idea struck, that was really kind of inspiring to me. For me, it wasn't about being an entrepreneur. It was about being an entrepreneur with an idea that really not just, you were passionate about, but for me that checked a bunch of boxes. For me, anything that I would do had to be big, it had to be different, it had to help society in some way, it had to be unique. If somebody said to me, you could make a different type of soda and make $1 billion, I wouldn't care. And so once that idea hit me around rewards for healthy behavior, you go, of course. And then, anybody that knew me knew that I would take it and run with it. So I don't think it was really, really that surprising. And, we used to, after working till, 10 o'clock at night, my brother used to come over to my law firm and we would business plan. And we'd try to figure out how to basically create this industry. So it was, once you get that energy around the idea, I don't think anybody was really surprised that I not too shortly after that, I took the leap.
Interesting. Now, during that time, were you involved in a relationship? Did you have any children?
Yes, I was involved in a relationship with my business. I wasn't. Over the course of that time, a little bit, I'm still single. I live in New York City. Over the course of that time, I had some relationships. But, one of the things that's hard, especially, and I think this is more my personality, once I got that in my crosshairs, I knew that it would be big and new and different, but also, really changing the healthcare industry, which would take a lot of time and effort and money. I got very single-minded. And so for me, when I'm into something, I'm into it. And so relationships were kind of secondary to me, and it was over a long period of time. And that may be a flaw, and it's something we talk about in the book, trying to create more balance around it. But I was pretty, I would wake up, without the alarm ringing in the morning, working on this business, and it was really kind of there. So I think relationships probably suffered a little bit.
For those listening who are considering being an entrepreneur, or are in the early stages of it, I recognize that you've said that you continue to be single, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what would the best partner be like for the person who's really dedicated to being an entrepreneur. What qualities does he or she have to have?
It's really a great question. In fact, one of the reasons why, we wrote and launched The Lonely Entrepreneur is because I look back now on things I could have done better. And I think that when it comes to the people that are around you, first of all, I think it's really hard to have your partner to be in the business with you. Being an entrepreneur is already a very visceral and emotional experience. When you start to broil into that, your husband, your wife, I think that gets more complicated. I think what your relationship and your partner has to do is they have to understand the experience that you're having. And what I mean by that is, no one cares as much as you do, right? And no one knows what it's like unless you're thinking about, not making payroll. I mean, these are the things that we as entrepreneurs naturally experience. I think more effort could be taken to help that significant other understand it's not just that we're a little nutty, right? It's that we feel these things. And if that significant other can be a vehicle to help kind of diffuse some of that at times, as opposed to saying, I just don't understand why somebody's working so hard, right? This is really becomes oxygen. We can't live without it. And so how do you bring your significant other into that experience where they can provide an independent voice and support, but they really have to understand what the struggle is like? And many times they do because they're sharing it financially or whatever, but I think they really have to understand the struggle. And if they do, then sometimes the things we do don't seem so strange.
It sounds like it might not be a good idea from your perspective for two entrepreneurs to come together, try to come together in a relationship, because they're both so torn in their own directions.
It's like two strong co-founders, right? That relationship is very unique. And I think that it's not necessarily that you couldn't have two entrepreneurs, because that mindset and understanding the life, I think, can be really good.
I see.
I think sometimes both of them working on the business together can be challenging. We have something in the book we called Seven Deadly Sins, things you shouldn't do. And one of them is having relationships with people in the business. There's too much energy and emotion and passion in the entrepreneurial experience itself. I think when you put two people in there that are also in a personal relationship, I think it's really difficult to hold each other accountable and really difficult to stay on track and, all the things that go with a well-run business that don't necessarily coincide with a well-run relationship.
The idea of leaving a position where you know what your income is going to be like for the most part on a regular basis and sort of throwing yourself out there, and now you have an idea but maybe not really, is there a way that you would recommend folks prepare for that reality?
In a lot of ways, it's the nature of the beast. I think one thing you can do, let's say you're somebody who's working in corporate America now and you have an idea, you're thinking about it, is you can do a lot of work, while you're there, right? You can take time, at nights and weekends to research, to really understand your market, to be as prepared as you can be when you do ultimately make the leap. And that, gives you the opportunity, even in corporate America these days, there's a lot of training programs within large companies, training people on entrepreneurism and different skills. I think financially, obviously, if you can build up a little bit of a war chest, to give you a little bit of a cushion to do it. But I think the biggest thing is being as prepared as you can be and doing as much work on foundational things, business planning, what you're going to need, before you actually walk out the door.
when you began your business, it took you some time. In fact, 10 years. This was your first company.
Yep.
10 years into your investment, 10 years into your company, 10 years into a life that was filled with everything that an entrepreneur's life is filled with. And then it seemed like you were really about to make it. So now you're on Easy Street, right? 10-year investment, and you're flying high, right?
Yeah, so think about what we were asking the healthcare industry to do. We're asking them to reward people who are doing the worst, right? Who are not paying attention to their health. So that took many, many years of convincing that industry, you know, that they should reward a pregnant mom or a diabetic or an asthmatic or, you know, for not doing the things that they should be doing. So we really fought upstream. Now we knew, today rewards in healthcare are everywhere. We knew our idea was sound because we knew at the end of the day that that people weren't doing what they were doing with health in their health, and they had to, and that's what ultimately needed to fix the healthcare system. But we had, after many, many years, we had convinced the industry, and we're really starting to hit our stride. We had many of the major health plans in the country, and many employers were clients of ours, you know, going into 2008. But it was, we had an unending belief, and what we used to tell our employees at the time was that, you know, Amazon told everybody that no one would ever buy a book in a bookstore again, and everybody laughed, right? And Starbucks said, we're going to put a store on every corner in cities where there's already tons of coffee, and we're going to charge, you know, three times what you normally charge, right? These are new and different ideas that take a long time, and each of those companies took a lot more money and a lot more time than it took. So I think your idea is so important. It's not just being an idea. It's not just being an entrepreneur. Is the idea compelling? That doesn't mean you have to change the world. You could have an idea for a different flower shop, right? And that can be compelling. But it took a long time to convince the industry, and took a lot of steadfastness to stick to it and you know, realize our vision.
So in 2008, things were wonderful, yes?
We had really hit our stride in 2008. You know, it took a bunch of years, but we were really, you know, we had also been talking about this before anybody else. It's almost like if somebody comes up with a fashion trend 10 years earlier and then 10 years later it comes around, you know, you get to be known for the company that was saying it before anybody else was. And in 2008, we had, like I said, we had lots of corporate clients. We had really hit our stride. We had just taken a pretty big private equity investment, which was going to give us the capital to grow, you know, even more. And it was really, not that it was a time for celebration, but it really should have been, because we had really kind of hit our mark. And obviously, as you know, things change pretty quickly.
You just use a term that some folks may not be familiar with, private equity investment. What does that mean?
So when you're raising money for a company, there's different levels of investment you can get. You can start out with things like, you know, money from friends and family. You can get money from, you know, angels that might typically put in, you know, $25,000 or $50,000 or $100,000. And then as you go up the ladder in size, the next level up is kind of venture capital that might invest $500,000, $1 million, or a couple million. And then private equity are much, much bigger investments. You know, they're larger institutions that might manage, for example, $1 billion, where they, you know, dole that out into the companies that they invest in. So sophisticated investors.
All right. So again, at that point, you were really on a roll. You were making it big. And in a lot of ways, it sounds like the world was in front of you in terms of doing the work that you loved and being the successful entrepreneur that you wanted to be. Michael, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for you to let us know what happened in 2008. Folks,
sure.
This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. Michael Dermer, you've written, as we've been discussing, a book entitled The Lonely Entrepreneur: The Difference Between Success and Failure is Your Perspective. So tell us about your perspective in 2008 as things began to change a little bit.
You know, if you remember that time, October 15, 2008, right when we closed the investment, you know, we were supposed to celebrate, and now we had a bunch of money, and we were going to, you know, basically try to own this industry that we had, you know, in some ways created. And literally almost overnight, the world came crashing down around us. I mean, if you remember the financial crisis of 2008, you know, banks and large corporate America, you know, the conversation was, are these companies going to survive? And, you know, many of them didn't. Some of our largest clients were companies that don't exist anymore. Washington Mutual, Countrywide Financial were two of the biggest banks in the country. General Motors was a huge client, which, if you remember at that time, the government, you know, bailed out. So our business that we had built up over the course of all the blood, sweat, and tears, and we had just kind of been prepared to really take over the industry, basically almost got destroyed overnight. And that was, you know, to have that happen after all those years of, you know, of building it up and all the time and effort of and money of so many different people was, that was real big boys and girls stuff.
In that kind of situation, many people would sort of fold up their tents and really struggling with depression and anxiety and all the things that make sense, go look for a job where they have a paycheck at the end of the week or at the end of the month. Is that what you did?
You know, I'm just not wired that way. I, you know, you kind of just dig in and figure it out. I just felt so obligated to other people, right? Certainly part of this was about me, but it was really more about my family that invested money and friends that invested money and the employees that relied upon us and our investors and our customers. I mean, when you take the view that, you know, you're kind of there to serve them, it never even crossed my mind to kind of bail and take a job. It was just a matter of, okay, you would kind of dust yourself off. And, you know, you got, unfortunately, during that time, if you remember, it was so chaotic that not just for us, but for everybody, that, you know, you would look at the street and you wouldn't decide whether you're going to go left or right on the street. You'd look at the street and decide whether the street was going to be there. And so, you know, digging in and trying to figure it out was one thing. You were doing it in uncharted territories. You had major banks failing and stock markets crashing and things like that. So, you know, one thing to put in the effort and the time, and you know, at that time, a normal day for us was a 20-hour day. I mean, we were just trying to save this business we had built, get up at 5 in the morning and, you know, go home at 10 o'clock at night and, you know, do it again, you know, for 2 years to basically save the business. So I just didn't have the time or the effort to think about, you know, running away from it. It was like, okay, how do I kind of stabilize this thing so we can, you know, kind of realize we were trying to.
One of the points that I think you make frequently in the book, and you just said it again, is that you just really weren't wired to do anything but do what you did. Does it take that kind of intensity? Does it take that kind of almost hard wiring in a person to really be able to survive and thrive as an entrepreneur?
I don't think so. I think it's a combination. You know, it's kind of like the nurture nature thing. Are you born with it or can you learn it? I think that there are certain characteristics, the ability to think of things differently and new ideas, the ability to have vision, the ability to have, you know, be comfortable with being uncomfortable, you know, some of the things we've been talking about before. But I also think that one of the disservices that we as a country have done to entrepreneurs is that we haven't said, this is something you should get better at. This is a skill you can improve upon, no different than, you know, a mom who's a mom for the first time is better, you know, as she does it more, or maybe the second time, or a, you know, a golfer gets better at their golf game. You do have some elements of DNA that you need, but then it shouldn't just be, okay, if you have these elements plus, you know, passion and grit, that's enough. You actually have to get better as an entrepreneur. You have to improve upon the skills, you know, some of them are personal skills we've been talking about, and others just business skills. And I actually think it's the combination of those two things that makes them the most successful entrepreneurs.
You go into giving examples of the kind of advice that can sort of drive entrepreneurs crazy, if you will.
Yeah.
Take a few days off. That seems like a reasonable piece of advice. No?
Well, here's what I would say. One of the challenges is that unless you've sat in the entrepreneur's shoes and experienced some of the things we've been talking about here, maybe not to the same extent we did in 2008, it's really hard to understand their perspective, right? So we as entrepreneurs, you know, we walk around saying things like no one cares as much as we do, right? Or, you know, you won't understand unless you've thought about missing payroll, right? Or, you know, somebody will say to us, someone will say to me, so do you prefer, you know, Mike or Michael? And I'll give them a half hour about the pricing model for my business, right? It's just, there's so much energy around this. So when outsiders that don't understand that say, you know what, if you just take a couple of days off, you'll be fine. To the entrepreneur, they go, those people are nuts. Those people have no idea what I'm experiencing, right? Because they're not living and breathing. There's ways you absolutely have to have releases, and you actually have to do that. And part of what we try to do with the Lonely Entrepreneur is to have the entrepreneur realize this kind of, we call it the brutal truth, that if their business is struggling, most likely it's because of some of these perspectives they have. I mean, it's perfectly reasonable, and you absolutely have to have ways to release yourself from the pressure. But you have to understand that the rest of the world doesn't, you know, walk around thinking the way that we think. And because of that, when somebody says, just go to the movies, just take a week off, we think they're from Mars, right? Even though it's very sound advice. So it's really more about managing our perspective, because there's a lot of people on the outside that actually not only are willing to help, but have very good, you know, really good advice to help you.
Speaking of perspective, I mean, you offer some, early on in The Lonely Entrepreneur, you offer some potential perspective changes. And the interesting one for me was the very first one on the list, where you say control, running the business instead of it running you. Say yeah. More about that.
So what a lot of entrepreneurs, the flawed perspectives that a lot of entrepreneurs have is they will say things like, I can't prioritize. How can I prioritize? I have to do everything, right? And what ends up happening is, you know, the business ends up kind of running you instead of you running the business. I mean, the best analogy I've gotten is, you know, you're standing in front of a dam and there's a hole that, you know, there's some water squirting out and you stick a finger in it and then there's another and another and soon you're using all your fingers and then using all your toes and then use your tongue, right? And you, that's the way it feels as an entrepreneur. And so the flawed perspective entrepreneurs have is, I can't prioritize. Well, as we all know, everybody in their jobs and their personal lives have more to do than they have time. So if you don't actually change that perspective and say, okay, I understand I have to do all these things across my business, I'm going to pick the top three priorities, right? And set those as priorities, meaning I'm going to have regular meetings about them. I'm going to have whatever resources I have work on them, bring our best thought to them. I'm going to check in on them, you know, once a week, whatever it may be. Unless you do that, then the business runs you, and you'll feel like you're kind of running around with chicken with their head cut off all the time. And these are just things that as an entrepreneur, we almost accept and say things to ourselves like, I can't prioritize, even though everybody knows that's a recipe for failure. So how do you recognize that you do have this flawed perspective and then take the steps to change it? Because as soon as you set those three priorities, you're going to go back to your desk and go, oh, wow, we're more organized, we're more structured, we're making more progress than ever before.
How important is consistency and organization and structure in the life and in the business of an entrepreneur?
So it's almost counterintuitive to an entrepreneur to say you need more structure and process, because the normal nature of an entrepreneur is like, okay, we want to innovate and we want to think and we want to evolve and we want to, right, do all those different things. Here's the problem. The less resources you have and the more you have to do, the more that it's really, really important to have process, right? So I'll give you an example. If you drive to work the same way every day, right, then you know how the traffic affects you, how the weather affects you, how other crazy drivers affect you, and you can adjust and you get better at going to work every day. If every day you went to work a completely different day, you wouldn't know how to deal with any of those things because you'd be dealing with them for the first time. So for an entrepreneur, right, they've got to put it, it's so important to put in place some process. Now, what do I mean by process? That might mean instead of having 40 emails go back and forth about how to design your product, right? You have a product meeting once a week where you sit there for an hour with deep thought with the right people, and that's when you have your product discussion. When somebody says on Thursday, we have this product thing, you put it in the product meeting, right? And so you create this structure for yourself so it doesn't seem as haphazard. And what that serves to do is it organizes you, it gets everybody on the same page, it eliminates a lot of wasted effort and time during the week. So if you get your company, even if it's just you yourself along with a part-time student that's helping you, right, sitting down and being organized, you can, instead of when you're updating people, right, instead of sending out 40 emails throughout the week, you know, once a week, put together a one-pager that updates all your constituents on what's happening with business. So there's a lot of this quote-unquote process, and sometimes people think process is a dirty word, but getting that process and structure in place actually makes you more efficient with your time and keeps you focused on the right stuff.
You talk about communications, and certainly in the life of an entrepreneur and even in the lives of the people who have chosen to sign on board with that entrepreneur, there's a lot of potential chaos in every day. And you talk about communicating in the face of chaos. How does one do that?
This is so endemic of the entrepreneurial venture, right? There's, like I said, somebody has a question about how to price it, and there's 27 emails back and forth, and that just all becomes really, really inefficient and needs people's time and effort. And so there's a couple of very simple perspectives and techniques that you can use. First of all, the person who's running it, you have to realize that even though you live and breathe every single detail, not everybody needs to know that. Your job is actually to simplify, right? So when somebody asks you a question, whether it's an employee or a customer or a vendor or an investor, your job is to simplify. It's not to dump everything you know and you've learned in the last 5 years about a particular issue. And that's a mindset for the leader. The techniques for that are you shouldn't be writing 10-paragraph emails, right? Write one-paragraph emails. Almost think of emails like Twitter, right? You can only send 140 characters. Because remember, we as entrepreneurs have lived and breathed every detail. So we think everybody else needs to know that. Our job is actually the opposite. Our job is to be intelligent enough to distill down all those details into the simplest of things, right? Think about this. The lonely entrepreneur for me has a 15-year history. And if I told you what it is, it's a destination to help entrepreneurs with the struggle about the personal and business issues they face. If I can't do that and I tell you my 10 years, right, your show is not long enough to do that. So simplifying is really key, and recognizing, again, in ourselves, it's our own flawed perspective that thinks everybody has to know the details. Things like putting out a one-pager, right, once a week, right, about updating people about the company. Even when you're writing complex things, right, even when you're dealing with, always boil it down to one page, right? If you can't say it in one page, make yourself do it. Because think about when somebody sends you a 10-page document.
Right.
You never read it.
Right.
But if somebody distills it down to the one page and then you say, right, I want to learn more, you'll do that. So it's creating these behaviors that create a lot of efficiency around a lot of the noise and effort that goes on in an entrepreneurial venture.
And it sounds like if you're able to do the consistent one page a week or 1 hour a week or, you know, however you approach it, that you cut down on some of the internal angst for the people who are working around you, which ultimately cuts down on the angst that you as the entrepreneur have to deal with. Is that?
100%. I mean, okay. A lot of this is just time and focus, like you said. When you get good process, I mean, think about this. Somebody raises an issue about what new color of lipstick we're going to have for our product. Right? And you have 27 emails back and forth and you have debates all day long versus, great, on Monday at 2:00, we have our lipstick meeting. And everybody show up and be prepared and we'll talk about the lipstick. So you can imagine the difference in effort of a focused hour with the right people in the room versus 100 emails about what's the best, you know, color for the lipstick.
You just used what for many people is a dirty word. You said hour. Now, there are people who believe that meetings should happen often and for hours. Is there, in your view, a length of time that one should, in which one should be able to accomplish whatever the goal is for that meeting? Is it 1 hour? Is it 2 hours? Should you just meet until you're all meted out?
So I don't think there's a magic time, but here's what I would say. Meetings are some of the most rewarding and also inefficient things that we do today, right? So it all depends how you run the meeting. In other words, if you go in and you say every week we're going to have the lipstick meeting and here is the agenda and here's what we're trying to get out of it and here's what we're going to try to do and we're going to hold ourselves to that, then meetings can be really, really efficient, even half-hour meetings. If you go in there and you have a two-minute conversation about lipstick and then everybody starts talking about what they wear to work, what they had for dinner, right, what everybody else is doing, and it gets disorganized. So you almost have to really think about creating a capability. This is what I was talking about before about being a better entrepreneur. Running good meetings sounds very basic, right? Running good meetings and getting organized about what your goals are, and when you do that consistently week to week, you get good at it. The length really depends on what you're trying to do. I tend to prefer a little bit longer meetings. Like I used to have, one-on-ones with everybody that reported to me for an hour, because I wanted to get everything done in that hour, right, where I knew what was going on and what we could talk about and how we could add to something. But I would say it's more important the structure of the meeting and holding others accountable to being disciplined about what you're doing there, as opposed to the time that's most important.
One of the things that you and you give lots of, I would suggest, guidance, and then you explain the benefit of the guidance that you're giving throughout the Lonely Entrepreneur. One of the points that you made, which just kind of, I think, jumps out for many people who are thinking about an entrepreneurial life, you say doing everything isn't dedication, it's bad leadership.
Yep. Again, this is one of these things that naturally develops for the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur says, I'm going to take all this on. It's all the things that I am. I have to do all these different things. Anywhere else in the world, if you said, I have to do everything, they would say, that's not somebody that can lead the company. I'll give you an example. Let's say that you walked in a pizza store and you got a great piece of pizza and you looked at the guy making the pizza and you said, wow, that guy's really terrific. And you said, I want to make 10 of these pizza stores, right? And that same guy said to you, but I have to make every slice. The first thing you would say is, well, I can't invest in that business because that guy can't make every slice. We can't do that. So as the entrepreneur, it is not a strength to say, I'm going to do everything, right? It is what is a real strength is saying, okay, I'm not supposed to be able to do everything, right? I'm actually supposed to figure out, number one, what are the top priorities of the company? Number two, how do I put some process in place, right, or to get more organized and structured? And number three, what are the things that I'm good at and not good at? And what are the things that I like and I don't like? And for me, really recognizing and having the humility to try to become a better entrepreneur, to actually learn and get better at it, that was a real aha moment for me, because then you embrace these things. You don't say, I have to do everything. You say, no, of course, that's not great leadership. We're going to fail. It's better to say, what are the things I can't do, shouldn't do, need help to do? And I'm not talking about that you have to have 100 people. It could be literally you and a friend that helps you out 3 days a week, right? But you really have to understand that for you, it's your own flawed perspective about thinking you have to do anything that will ultimately lead to your business moving really, really slowly.
Gotcha. Michael, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with The Lonely Entrepreneur. Folks, don't go away. We'll return in a minute. Michael, one of the pieces of advice that you offer is how to negotiate when essentially you don't feel like you have anything with which to negotiate. How do you do that?
So, you know, as an entrepreneur, you are normally coming to the table and you don't have, you know, a lot of money. You don't have necessarily, you know, the ability to commit a lot, right? Because you don't know exactly where your business is going. And you have to figure out a way to negotiate from a position of strength. And that's a really unnatural thing to do because you don't feel like you're coming from a position of strength. So what you have to do, again, it's a change in perspective. You have to figure out ways to give yourself kind of this leverage and this presence. So for example, you could go into an investor meeting and you're trying to raise some money for your business, and you might not have even been able to afford the cab or the Uber ride right over to the investor's office. And yet you need to be able to go in there and say to the investor, you know, our business is going to go from point A to point B. It's just a matter of whether you're going to be on that train or not. And some of that is really, really counterintuitive. The other thing you have to do is create leverage for yourself, right? So if you're negotiating, for example, with a vendor and you don't have a lot of capital, you can't commit a lot of volume to them, you know, make sure that vendor understands, number one, the opportunity that's going to exist in the future of working with your business, but also that they're competing against other vendors, right, for your business. So you have to kind of create this different pieces of leverage that give you the opportunity to negotiate from a position of strength as opposed to a position of weakness. But again, you can probably tell the common theme amongst everything I'm talking about. It's our own perspective as entrepreneurs when we're under the pressure that cause us to do a lot of these things that we've been talking about, including to go in there and you know, ask for money as opposed to going in there confidently about what you're doing and compelling investors to invest with you or vendors to work with you or employees to come work for your company.
So rather than asking for money, you're giving them the opportunity to invest in your product.
That's exactly right. In the beginning of our business, I would ask people, I was like, why is there so much attention around us? And one of my ex-marketing people, vendors, said to me, he goes, Michael, you guys just portray that you're going on a train and the train's going to point A or point B. It's just a matter of the people going to be smart enough to get on the train or not. And that may have been our style, but you never, let's put it this way, you never win when you negotiate from a position of weakness.
It's true.
So you have to create your own leverage. Even if you're talking to somebody and you know you could be talking to them or talking to their competitor, right? There's just different ways, again, using what we have as entrepreneurs, the ability to think about things differently. So how can you employ that to giving yourself opportunities to negotiate from more of a position of strength?
With all the conversations that we've had today, it's sort of clear that not only is being an entrepreneur sort of in your blood, but, you know, you live, you breathe, you eat, you sleep being an entrepreneur. And speaking of sleep, you make an interesting point. You suggest that one plan to get 8 hours of sleep once per week, take daily naps, and silence your technology. What does that have to do with being a quality entrepreneur?
So this is like I talked about before. You know, we say have passion and grit, which means work 24 hours a day, don't sleep, or being better at it. So I'll tell you what happened to me. I was working those 20-hour days in 08 to 2010, and people would come to me and say, Michael, you need to sleep more. And I would say what normal entrepreneurs would say is say, who has time to sleep? I'm trying to save my business. And then one day, I think it was like 4:30 in the afternoon, I sat down on a couch in my office, and I just happened to fall asleep for a half hour. Remember, I was working until 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night every night. And I woke up, and I felt so much better. I felt so much more productive. And I was like, wow. That's just a half hour. And then once a week, I got 8 hours. And I felt so much better all week. So it's just a matter of overcoming those, you know, natural perspectives that we have about that. The other thing is just about silencing technology, not just related to sleep, but so many times we'll sit down at our computer to do something and we'll have our cell phone on or have our email, you know, popping and things like that. And those things are incredibly distracting. So one of the tools and techniques about being an entrepreneur is, how do you manage your sleep so you're more productive, right? And how do you ultimately take technology when you're trying to be focused? Here's what I said this to a colleague the other day, kind of half kidding. She was telling me how she doesn't sleep very well. And I said, I would never hire you. She's like, what do you mean? She's like, if you can't manage your own sleep and your own productivity, what makes you think you can be productive at work? So this is a skill, right? As opposed to the normal perspective of, I have to work 24 hours a day, I don't have time to sleep.
That really is a different perspective, and it really is an interesting perspective. And the idea of silencing your technology, you know, we live in a world where everything is supposed to be available to you 24/7. You're supposed to be available to it 24/7. You know, people have rings and watches and necklaces, all of which allow them to know they've got a call coming in, they've got an email coming in, and you're saying that there's a period of time when you should silence all of that? I think you're making some people a little nutty even as we speak.
I can tell you, just try it. Just one time, right? Sit down at your computer when you want to try to get something done. Close your email and put your cell phone on the other side of the room, and see how much more productive you are, as opposed to opening up your email every time it pops on your screen. I mean, listen, one of the problems is when you're sitting in your apartment, right, by yourself, and somebody sends you an email, you want the energy, your angst to go somewhere, so you want to go answer it and participate and all. Just shut it down and try it once. And I think what you'll find is, you know, put aside separate time to go through your email, and so you'll be so much more productive. So at the end of the day, you're like, oh, I'm better at this. I'm making more progress on my business and things like that.
Okay. Tell us about the four P's. What are they?
The four P's. And so I've mentioned a couple of times being kind of under the pressure of being the entrepreneur that causes all these flawed perspectives. It's actually not just pressure. It's four P's. It's pressure, passion, pleasure, and pain. And so the pressure is obviously some of the things we've been talking about, the pressure of, you know, leaving a job and financial pressure and all that stuff. But those other three P's have just as much of an impact on these flawed perspectives. So secondly is passion, right? You will say, I live in New York City. Someone will say, I'm going to open up a new meatball shop. And your friends will say, well, you know, there's a lot of really great meatballs in New York City. And you'll say, yeah, but not my meatballs, right? We get so ingrained in our idea. A typical example of that is when you're hiring employees, right? You will say, okay, well, the person in front of me, I like them. I have this great gut feeling about them. I'm going to bring them on, even though they may not be qualified at all to do the things that I need them to do, right? But our passion and energy for the business makes them go, okay, I'm just going to grab this person and go. The same thing's true with pleasure and pain. You know, pleasure, you get these really interesting highs from really small things, right? You know, your first business card, your first logo, your first customer, your first website, your first marketing campaign. And then finally the pain, right? In the same way you get the pleasure when those things don't go so well, you feel that. All of those four P's together, when we're under the influence of things, that's what caused us to develop these flawed perspectives. And if we can recognize that we're developing them and understand it's the nature of the beast, then we can apply a lot of the tools that we lay out in The Lonely Entrepreneur and a lot of the things that you and I have been discussing here.
The idea of changing perspective, what's the process of actually doing that? I mean, you've been talking about some ideas and some ways to think about things that are, as you've said, they are absolutely counterintuitive to many folks and certainly to entrepreneurs. So what's the process, if there is one, of changing your perspective so you're looking at it in a way that allows you to be more productive?
So I think the first thing is universal across this is I referenced it before, it's kind of this thing we call the brutal truth, which is that if your business is struggling or not doing as well as you'd want it to be, it's most likely your fault. And that's kind of really unfair because we're the only ones that kind of put our money in and don't sleep and do all the things that we're talking about here. Once you recognize that it's your own perspective about a lot of things we've been talking about here that's the issue, then you actually embrace getting better out of it. So that's a foundational thing. Across a lot of the different things that I've been talking about here, the way you change perspective is different every time. You know, we talked about the one pager for communication, right? Or negotiating from a position of strength. one of the things about that foundational perspective of the brutal truth is there's a lot of people that have been through this. You know, one of the things we're trying to do with The Lonely Entrepreneur is empower people with these tools. So the ideas that we're bringing is once you embrace getting better at it, right, then when you think about communication, you can talk to somebody. You can come to somebody at some place like The Lonely Entrepreneur, and they will say, oh, by the way, writing 100 emails is actually not the right way to do it. So the foundation is, even though the changing of perspective might be different every time, about how you do it. The first is, okay, we're not doing this right. I'm not doing this. How do I find out how to do it correctly? And that it might be talking to an experienced friend, right? About, you know, I may be looking to hire that employee and that employee needs to know nuclear physics. And I go, yeah, but I can teach them nuclear physics. Where if you had a friend of yours interview them, they'd go, no, they don't know anything about nuclear physics. Once you recognize that getting better as an entrepreneur is the core perspective, then there's lots of ways to figure out how to the specific changes you have to make in different circumstances. And that's obviously, as you can imagine, what we're trying to do at The Lonely Entrepreneur as well.
And it sounds like the ability to take a look at yourself and not feel the need to think that everything you do is right or that everything you do is wrong, that's really important too.
It really is. And a lot of our own ego and self-esteem is tied up on this. And I know a day for me that was really liberating was when I really embraced being a better entrepreneur. Instead of worrying about what I didn't know and what we didn't doing, I said, okay, I'm going to get better at this. And once you do embrace getting better at this, then when you're just really looking for solutions, you're not worrying about perceptions or how you look or what you know or what you don't know. And many entrepreneurs, you know, think about a chef or a doctor or kind of a fashionista or a technologist, right, or a creative person. All of those people have an amazing set of skills. That does not mean that the chef runs a great restaurant or the doctor runs a great doctor's office, okay? Embracing that and saying, I have a great set of skills, but I need to complement that with other ideas and skills, even if they aren't other people, even if it's just friends and colleagues that are willing to help. When you embrace that, you embrace the humility that goes with that and the learning process of, you know, we say being an entrepreneur is not a job, it's an identity. And if you embrace it that way, I think you really try to go on a journey of chipping away and getting better at these. And then you'll look back a year later going, I can't believe I used to try to get this document done when I had my email open all the time.
Interesting. You tell people to do the hardest thing in first time in the morning. Why is that important to do the hardest thing in the morning?
So this is just one of those things entrepreneurs should get better at, right, is managing your day, right? So one of those things is, right, you have this brain power that you're going to use throughout the day, and you've got something that requires a lot of thought or creativity or energy, do it first thing, right? It's when your brain is the sharpest. It's when you have the most energy. We all know what it's like at 7 o'clock at night when we try to sit down and write something really complex or do something complex or thoughtful. Do it first thing in the morning, but also when you do it, turn off your stuff, right? Turn off your cell phone, turn off your email, and focus. Then it's, you know, it's 9 a.m, you've knocked off the most important thing, and not only do you have the feeling of knocking it off, but now you're going to go into your day already getting something done and not having that hang over your head, you know, all day long.
You suggest to folks that they put a time limit on sending out emails, and certainly I think we probably both know people who think if you send out an email at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning, that's a great thing because you're really showing that you're dedicated. But you're saying, no, don't send anything out after 10 p.m. Why is that?
Most of the bad things that have happened on the planet happen after 10 p.m., right? Here's what I would say. Again, you hit it right on the head, totally counterintuitive. I'm going to send out the email at 12 o'clock. Here's what it does. Number one is you're usually pretty worn out by that time. You're not as thoughtful. You're not as deliberate. You know, may feel angst or stress from the day. It just doesn't make sense. But secondly is it sends the wrong types of messages, right? Imagine you have an employee that you pay $20,000 a year and they really work their butt off. They work till 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night and you send them a, you know, page and a half email at midnight. In that way, you're not respecting boundaries. You're not respecting their time. You wear them down. All these things that to your exact point, and it's the whole point we've been making here, your perspective is those are the things that are a good thing. They're actually a bad thing, right? Stick it in your draft folder. Don't send it out. I guarantee, I'll bet anybody a dollar that 9 times out of 10, you're like, wow, I was really going to send that. And it, this is just, you can probably tell, this is I'll use a sports analogy. This is like a golfer. A golfer works on their putting. They work on their short game. They work on their iron game. What we're really encouraging people to do is say, you can get better as being an entrepreneur. And we've talked about communication and managing your day, and we've talked about every aspect of the business. When you make these incremental changes, you actually get better at it, and you do what's important, which is make more progress in your business.
Which is absolutely what you really want to do as an entrepreneur.
Yep, yep. And there's plenty of effort. There's plenty of people spending effort and kind of working their tails off. It's, can you get better at it so you actually drive a better result? If your employees are clearer because you communicate better, right, they're more productive. When they're more productive, you're going to, your marketing is going to go better. Your sales are going to go better. Your money is going to come in more. Right? And if you can, this isn't one big course, right? It's, you can do little things in your day to get better at it, and then you'll start to see some momentum in that, where you actually start to see the improvements in your business.
Michael, we could talk at least for another couple of hours. Clearly, there's so much information in The Lonely Entrepreneur. Please give folks your website.
Sure. It's lonelyentrepreneur.com, and what you'll see there is a whole series of resources. We've got coaching programs. One is a do-it-yourself coaching program where you can go on there and for a little bit of money just go through a lot of the perspectives we talked about here. We also have group coaching and one-on-one coaching. And next year, we're actually going to be launching a whole learning platform where people can go in and learn about marketing and sales and hear all about these different perspectives. And, of course, you have the Lonely Entrepreneur book, which is available on our website and at Amazon.
So the lonelyentrepreneur.com is the best place to go to get lots more information. Michael Dermer, I have to thank you so much for joining us today. I've already recommended your book, by the way, to one person. So,
thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is available to you on demand 24/7 simply by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It is provided as a daily public service. It is in no way intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly or like to make a comment about today's program, you can always send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And folks, always, always remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.